It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover, starting with local and apparently some new height limits here in South Lake Union.
Oh, no, just for one property only. The city council this week, in a 7-1 vote, approved a height increase for one building site in South Lake Union from 85 feet to 125 feet. And can you guess who that building site belongs to?
Oh, wait a minute. It's on the tip of my tongue. go ahead, tell me.
Well, Paul Allen's development company, Vulcan.
No.
Yes, and it's part of the project for the expansion of the UW. Vulcan is building some buildings in South Lake Union, and the project is almost complete. Well, they went to the city council and they said, I know you increased the height limits for us before, specifically for this type of project. 285 feet, but for this one building, we want to go to 125 feet. And oh, by the way, can you expedite the process so that it doesn't go through a complete review? And the Seattle City Council rolled over and said, oh, yes, anything for Mr. Allen.
And let me guess, Nikocata was the one vote.
Yes, you guessed correctly. And what was interesting was the dynamics of the vote, too. The performance of the two new city council members, Sally Bagshaw and Mike O'Brien. Sally Bagshaw is clearly stepping into Jan Drago's shoes and becoming the shill for Vulcan on the city council, because she was the one who really was the booster for pushing the vote through and getting the vote done. And Mike O'Brien, who was sort of supposed to be an environmental candidate, he sort of sat there and proved that he didn't really understand zoning rules at all, and just kind of smiled and supported his vote by saying, "Oh, this will help make Seattle a great city," sort of echoing his campaign. Some of his campaign rhetoric.
Yeah. And he did talk about wanting to promote density and whatnot, which again was the sort of the boilerplate rhetoric from the pro-density environmental movement that both McGinn and Greg Nichols have exemplified.
But most of the pro-density arguments talk about housing.
Of course.
Not about projects for the University
I understand
of
that.
Washington.
You understand
Paul
that.
Allen.
Our listeners understand that.
Uh-huh. So that kind of shows you what Mike O'Brien's positions really are.
It was interesting, too, looking at the city council hearings on this, that the first one was packed with half the people being Vulcan, UW, paid people to be there, and the other half being local residents, and you knew which way they spoke. I mean, the people who lived there spoke against it, and people from UW and Vulcan spoke for it.
That building at 125 feet is going to stand out like a sore thumb.
It's going to basically be South Lake Union's equivalent of the Safeco Tower.
Yeah,
well, it'll be right there on Mercer, too.
Block a lot of light and a lot of views.
All right. But it'll make a lot of money for Paul, and UW wanted it, so, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That's for the kids. Let's move on. Mayor McGinn coming out this week and looking for a significant chunk of change for a new seawall.
Yeah, a couple $100 million for a new seawall. And this is money that the city was obligated to spend anyway. It's actually part of the 900-some million dollars that the city is obligated to come up with money for as its share of the whole plan around building a tunnel through downtown Seattle with the deep bore technology. What this did, because McGinn has separated that out from the tunnel project and said, well, we're going to need to do this regardless of what we do. You know, the seawall needs replacing. It's an expense the city needs to buck up and cough up money for one way or another. Anyway, that has triggered a lot of speculation that McGinn once again might be backing down on his commitment to see the tunnel through, which in turn, there seems to be a lot of distrust all the way around on this score. This was the opening week of the state legislature down in Olympia, which we'll talk a lot more about in a moment. But one of the bills that was introduced that was actually co-sponsored, one of the two lead co-sponsors on it was Senator Ken Jacobson of Seattle, but the other was the Senate Transportation Chair. They have introduced a bill, both of those are Democrats, have introduced a bill that would basically forbid any bypass any permitting processes by cities on state transportation projects, state highway transportation projects. Specifically, it would exempt the state highway department of transportation from their requirement to get those local government permits. Now, that is almost certainly directed straight at the two largest pending state highway projects, which are a replacement for Highway 99, which is the Alaska Way Viaduct, and the State Route 520 Evergreen Point Floating Bridge, both of which require the city of Seattle to sign off on them. And so even though McGinn talked a lot about wanting to build bridges, no pun intended, with Olympia and restore some of the frayed relationships that had been soured during the Greg Nichols era, right off the bat we're seeing Olympia not trusting McGinn at all to honor his commitments on state highway projects, and McGinn for his part separating out the portions of a state highway project that he really supports and the city has to do, namely the seawall, from something that it doesn't really support, which is the tunnel project. So that may not be a dead issue at this point.
All right. Well, then that takes us on, as you previously mentioned, to the state legislature and budget issues.
Yeah. In December, Governor Gregoire, it's actually part of her job description to draft a state budget plan, send it to Olympia, and then the Democrats and Republicans in the legislature, they kind of argue over it and add things, subtract things, and eventually pass a budget plan through the House and Senate, the state House and Senate. Well, in
Raise
December...
Send it to Olympia. She's in Olympia, too.
She's in Olympia, too, yeah. Well, Gregoire, in December, drafted an all-cuts budget. There's about a $2.6 billion shortfall between revenue and expenses this year, and the original budget plan that she drafted in December would have taken care of that shortfall by making just cuts and no increases in revenue. Well, when she announced that plan, she said, well, I'm not happy with this. This is just a first draft. This lets you know what it would look like if we didn't do any tax increases, and it looks pretty gruesome, and I'm going to do a second draft in January. So in January, just this week, she announced her second draft of a plan, and it was very, very interesting. She put back in about $779 million of the cuts, which that means human services would be cut by about $433 million, most of it in education programs. But the overall spending cuts that are still in her budget are about $1 billion. That means that to cover that $2.6 billion shortfall, that she would have to come up with another about $1.6 billion in tax increases. Well, she did propose some tax increases by closing a few tax loopholes of about $100 million, and then she sent the budget on to Olympia saying, yeah, I know there's still a $1.5 billion hole in there. I'm going to let the Democrats in the legislature figure out how to handle that, what kind of tax increases to do. So in other words, her budget plan, her second budget draft, doesn't balance, which I don't know if you can really call that a budget when you give the draft to the legislature and it just doesn't balance.
Well, I could draft an unbalanced budget for the state legislature. In the next 5 minutes. Here, why don't you spend $100 million on my pet project, and you can worry about everything else.
That's right. That's right. And so the Democrats in the legislature are going to have to do Gregoire's job for her, essentially. They're going to have to scramble around and figure out what kind of tax increases they can do. And, of course, they've put property taxes aside and said, we're not going to increase property taxes. So that's completely off the table. But they're looking hard at the state sales tax, which hasn't been increased since 1983, 6.5%. In places like the city of Seattle, for example, we've seen the sales tax increase mostly because of local taxes that are imposed by the city or the county, but the state sales tax portion hasn't increased for many, many years. So the legislature is probably going to be looking at that, either that or an extension of sales tax to services or to other things that haven't had a sales tax charged on them, like certain types of food, candy, for example, or bottled water, is another example. And they figure, and the Democrats in the legislature are hoping that the federal government will come through and give us some money again this year like they did last year. For example, they're hoping that the federal government will decide that, oh, yes, we are, haven't been fair in our Medicare reimbursements to the state of Washington, so here's an extra $500 million for you, or here's an extra $1 billion for you. That's a pretty slim hope, but that's what the Democrats in the legislature are talking about right now. So one of the other interesting things about this, too, is in order to pass a tax increase of any kind, the legislature is going to have to decide whether or not they're going to repeal or suspend I-960, the Iman initiative that was passed a couple of years ago that says that the legislature can't increase taxes without a two-thirds majority or approval by voters. So since 2 years have passed now, since that initiative was passed, the legislature can now revisit that initiative and repeal it or suspend it.
And the initiative was passed fairly narrowly in a very different economy.
Oh, yeah. So that's probably the first order of business for them.
All right. So was there a response from the other party?
There is another party. Because I noticed you kept saying Democrats in Olympia, and Democrats need to do... There are actually two parties that are responsible for the welfare of the general public. And I know
you pay attention to the Republicans, and I don't.
Well, this is sort of an interesting question. With the state in such a world of economic hurt, what would be a good alternative solution if you don't like the solutions that the Democrats are offering? Well, I'm glad you asked that, because the Republican Party of Washington State, the Washington State Republican Party, seems to be primarily focused in this legislative session, at least so far, on rewriting the commerce phrase to the U.S. Constitution. A number of the bills that have been introduced on the Republican side, and these are bills that have been sponsored by anywhere between a handful and most of the Republican delegation, have been focused around the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution, and that is the amendment that gives the states rights, that defers to the states rights not elucidated in the U.S. Constitution. Well, there's a Palinist/Tea Party/extreme conservative populist argument making the rounds right now that is arguing that basically this means that the federal government, because it's of course controlled by that socialist Obama, actually he's many other things besides a socialist, but we'll stop with that. that states should have the right to opt out from all of this because it's all unconstitutional and communist and all those horrible things. And so you have Representative Matt Shea, who's behind a number of these bills, talking about how it'll give Washington and other individual states a fighting, this is a direct quote, to detach from a federal budget in free fall and save the economies of the individual states. So, okay, they want Washington State to decouple from the federal budget. That's a start. So you have Shea and 19 co-sponsors with HB 2709, the Washington State Firearms Freedom Act of 2010, which, among other things, would legalize and deregulate both silenced and cop-killer bullets and exempt Washington from all federal firearm regulations and registration laws. That's 6 weeks after Maurice Clemens. We have HJM 4010, which asks Congress to do away with both the Federal Reserve and all paper money and go to gold and silver currency only. We have HB 2712, the Washington State Sovereignty and Federal Tax Escrow Account Act of 2010, which has 15 co-sponsors, which would require that all federal taxes be remitted to the state and held in escrow, and any actions against the feds against a Washington State citizen for complying with the act, like not paying the IRS your taxes, would be considered a, quote, hostile and unconstitutional act against Washington State and its citizen, and against which the state would take all necessary measures, which is basically a call for secession.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of these bills were already up for procedural motions this week. Procedural motion to move two bills to the floor for a vote without any hearings at all or debate, those being HB 2669, which would exempt Washington from the national health care reform, any such measures that were passed, and HB 2708, which would declare null and void any federal greenhouse gas or fuel economy regulations. Those got the support of every single Republican. That is, in other words, a big chunk of the Republican House delegation is pushing secession from Washington State, and this raises a couple of questions.
From the federal government.
Or from the federal government, rather. Yeah, from the state, too, really, when you get right down to it, because they basically want to be, you know, declared exempt from anything and anyone that they don't agree with, whether they live here or anywhere else in the country. But it raises a couple of immediate questions. Number one, this is what they're most worried about when the state is in economic freefall. Mm-hmm. This is one of the two major parties that, you know, after the Democrats, is most likely to govern our state. That's kind of alarming. That's one. And second is, why is this not getting any media coverage? You know, why can you have all sorts of ridiculous bills in the House and Senate that do get media coverage, and all sorts of foibles the Democrats do, but when you have a major state party engaging in this kind of, not to put too fine a spin on it, seditious legislation,
and
why is nobody paying attention to it?
And it's wasting time.
It's wasting a lot of time.
They could be putting forth some real alternatives to what the Democrats are proposing, and they're not, really. I mean, they're wasting their time on these things that are completely divorced from reality, which is why when I talk about the budget, I say the Democrats this, the Democrats that, because it's the Democrats, really, that are doing the work.
Yeah, because nobody else, you know, because the Republicans mm-hmm. simply aren't. And we're seeing a similar sort of dynamic at the congressional level and the federal level, too, that... Mm-hmm. That the Republicans simply are not participating in the governing process.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, moving on. Speaking of governing, Governor Chris Gregoire has a plan for jobs.
Yeah, right after she announced her budget that doesn't balance, she announced a plan to create jobs. And I thought that was kind of interesting, because as soon as she started talking about creating jobs, I could just see more tax loopholes opening, you know, right before my very eyes. I was like, okay.
The gates swinging open.
Yes.
Buckets of money pouring through.
Buckets of money pouring out of the state coffers to businesses to lure them to the state of Washington. For example.
Or in the case of Microsoft or Boeing.
Yeah. She proposed a new employee tax credit for every quote-unquote small business that hires a new full-time employee, and then of course she didn't define what small meant in terms of small business. And then she also directed state agencies to start a green building program to retrofit state buildings to create jobs. That's a good idea, but when there's no money in the state coffers for this, and she's not proposing any way to raise money, it's just not going to go anywhere. And or it's going to suck money from other programs that need it, like, for example, the basic health plan, which is supposed to serve the state's poorest residents and provide them some kind of health care coverage. That is really at risk of being cut completely this year. But we've got our governor talking about creating a clean energy business development program to attract new businesses to the state, and not providing any other means for funding that program. Gregoire also got together. She had another announcement this week, too. She got together with some state and local law enforcement people, and she said, we're going to change the way the state handles violent mentally ill offenders. Now, this is something that needs to be done. Maurice Clemens, for example, is a good reason why the state needs to really seriously look at how we handle violent, mentally ill felons and people who are, for example, convicted or arrested for assault and just processed through the system and allowed back on the street without any consideration for whether or not they're going to offend again and maybe be much, much more violent the second time. But they propose some changes that I think are not going to help a whole lot. She's proposing that a state constitutional amendment that would allow judges to deny bail in more types of cases. That may help. However, there was no mention of where these people are going to be put when in a system where we're struggling for funding and struggling to find places for people who have mental health issues. Who are being turned out on the street and released to community supervision when they probably need to remain in inpatient care. She's also talking about higher penalties for family members who try to assist mentally ill offenders and more severe sentences for felons who don't comply with community supervision without, of course, any discussion of where money is going to come from to ensure there are more case officers and better follow-up in the community supervision programs. And she wants to make it easier to involuntarily commit people, even though, again, where's the money going to come from to expand the inpatient system when the trend has been over the last 30 or 40 years to close down hospital beds and places for people who are mentally ill. So that kind of takes care of the Gregoire roundup this week.
All right. Well, still sticking with Olympia, there was at least one initiative proposed this week.
Yeah, an initiative which would actually, potentially anyway, have quite an impact on the budget, which would be an initiative
A positive impact, yes.
An initiative filed by a new group called Sensible Washington that would decriminalize marijuana. This would be a statewide initiative for the fall ballot. It will take a couple, 3 weeks for that initiative to be processed by the Secretary of State's office. And at that point, assuming that it is approved, they would have a certain number of days to get a couple hundred thousand signatures to get it on the fall ballot. Probably by mid-July would be the timeline at this point. Now, the initiative, as proposed, would decriminalize possession of marijuana, not medical marijuana, but any marijuana in the state. It does not talk about distribution and how people would get that marijuana, other than to say that it's the intent of the initiative that the legislature consider a system for distribution and taxation. There are a couple of ways in which this could impact the state budget. One, of course, is that the state already has a statewide distribution system for hard liquor, that those being the liquor stores, and it would be a fairly simple matter to add marijuana to that and to figure out a way to regulate and to tax marijuana, which could have a huge impact on the state's budget. But above and beyond that, there's also the money saved if you're suddenly not prosecuting nonviolent drug offenders, marijuana being by far the bulk of those offenders. It would save a huge amount of money on state and local budgets in the justice systems, both for law enforcement costs and also within the justice system and also within costs of jail and imprisonment. So that measure, if it is approved by the state Secretary of State, will be available for petition signing in a couple 3 weeks.
Yeah, and you know, this week a King 5 survey found that 56% of Washington residents support the legalization of marijuana for adults, and that 54% say that marijuana should be sold in state liquor stores and subject to state taxes. So there's support here. And if you see the initiative, I'd urge you to sign it.
All right, moving on. We are going to skip national and move to international and the earthquake in Haiti.
Yeah, it's been all over the news this week, but there are some aspects of it that haven't been all over the news. One of the things that really kind of yanked my chain this week was that you'd kind of see hints of this in news reports. If you were reading the news in the paper or online, you'd see little hints of this, but nobody ever really pointed it out explicitly, that one of the reasons why there's been problems getting aid flights into the airport in Haiti, Port-au-Prince Airport in Haiti, is that much of Haiti's elite, after having, you know, spent decades looting the nation's treasury, packed up their belongings and commandeered private jets and you know, fueled them up, took the remaining fuel in the Port-au-Prince airport, and they flew out for Miami. So those folks, after having looted the country, left it like rats deserting a sinking ship. And that has contributed a lot to the fact that in these very important first 3 days after the earthquake, it's been very difficult for airplanes to land at the airport, and once they land, they can't refuel.
Yeah, and one of the things that's been driving me nuts about the media coverage in particular is it's invariably accompanied by these stories about why is Haiti so unfortunate? And, you know, it talks about civil strife and there's frequent changes of government. And one of the things that it never quite gets around to mentioning is that the U.S. has been behind a lot of this. That even with Pat Robertson's fractured history, leaving out the fact that when the Haitian slaves revolted in early in the 19th century, that the United States not only wouldn't recognize but led an embargo against Haiti for a couple of generations all the way through the Civil War because southern slave-owning states didn't want their own chattel getting the wrong idea about, you know, freedom and democracy and all that kind of thing. And that's been straight up through various, you know, military occupations and U.S.-backed coups and U.S.-backed dictators all the way through the 20th century. There really has been a systematic looting of the
21st century, really.
And the 21st century, too.
because it was
certainly all the way through the 20th. And
it was just 5 years ago, I think, that Jean-Bertrand Aristide was shoved out of the country because
for the second time.
Yeah,
actually, the third time.
Yeah, because the U.S. would not support his presidency.
Yeah. And in fact, you saw Aristide in the news this week literally weeping in South Africa because even while the wealthy have fled his country in droves, he wants to go back and help out but can't.
He wants to do the job he was elected to do that the elites here in the West, in the Western Hemisphere, would not allow him to do, and most particularly the U.S. government would not allow him to help his own people out of poverty.
Yeah, so really one of the great untold stories of this tragedy is that the reason why there are tens, maybe hundreds of thousands dead rather than hundreds, maybe thousands dead has not so much to do with the severity of the earthquake and everything to do with the poverty of Haiti, the lack of infrastructure, the lack of building code, the lack of trees on the hillsides, and why all that has happened. It's been very much a man-made tragedy.
Mm-hmm. And you gotta look at the fact that, like, the corporate news media are sent all their, you know, their nightly news guys are, like, broadcasting from there within 24 hours, yet the U.S. response on this is, like, you know, they're saying, well, there's an aircraft carrier on the way.
Yeah, you know? we're giving it a little bit.
I mean, we're 600 miles
dollars.
From there, and we can't, like, you know, if the airport's jammed up, you can't, like, land on a friggin' beach. I mean, you could if you wanted to get the military in there.
Well, most container ships need a dock and equipment.
And loading equipment.
But
that's true, but you can get some minor infrastructure in
there. Yeah, where the helicopters, of course, we're stretched with not having many National Guard to send because they're over in Iraq and Afghanistan. But still, I mean, there are other nations in the region that the U.S. could get together and get them to help out in the rescue effort, but the coordination has been minimal, and it's just been a disaster.
And specifically, there are all kinds of health facilities 50 miles away in Cuba that could be used except for U.S. policy.
Yeah, and the most the U.S. would do with Cuba is ask for permission to use their airspace, which is ridiculous. Cuba should be leading the effort, I think.
All right. Well, just another minute or so to go. Why don't we go to events?
Yeah, a couple of events coming up this weekend. Of course, it's MLK weekend, and so a couple of events that happen this time every year. One is at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action over in Kitsap County outside the Bangor Nuclear Subbase is having one of their annual MLK actions. That'll be all day today. It actually started a few minutes ago all the way through 4 o'clock. There'll be vigil nonviolence trainings and a nonviolent direct action that'll be happening later today at the gates of Bangor. Also on Monday morning and midday, the annual workshops and rally and march that'll be happening in Garfield High School, 23rd and Jefferson. Workshops will be at 9:30 in the morning. There will be a rally, community rally, at 11 o'clock and at noon march to the federal building to talk about both social justice and the need for human needs in this economic downturn. So turn out for that. It's really the closest thing that Progressive Seattle has to an annual convention.
Yeah, and we'll hope for good weather and good turnout for that.
Yep.
Let's talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
Eat This State comes out every couple weeks with, you know, the usual humor and news and opinion, and especially opinion. You can find it wherever you find free publications, bookstores, King County Library System, etc. You can also find it at the web at www.eatthestate.org. And we are in the middle of a fund drive right now. That's because, quite frankly, we're out of money, and we owe quite a bit of money to our printer. And in fact, we made a decision just this past week that we may not be able to continue printing if within the next month or so we can't raise the additional $3,000 or so that we need in our fund drive. We're really hurting that badly. So if you can do anything to help us get not just the website and not just the radio show, but also the print publication out there, we would really appreciate it. You can go to our website, www.eatthestate.org, to donate via PayPal, or you can send checks or money orders to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you have any questions on that or comments or tips, you can go to our website or you can email us. That email is info@eatthestate.org.